You're listening to The Stag, first broadcast on the 21st of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Some northern soul in print from Liverpool, Manchester and beyond. A careful approach to typography and architectural photography. The best of British publishing with daring fashions and creative cover spreads, new and old, today on The Stag. The British independent magazine sector shows its true colours today as we explore topics as varied as brutalist concrete landmarks and a long-gone Liverpudlian music scene. We see how Cool Britannia emerged on the pages of some influential men's titles, and we flick through a magazine that takes its name from that most essential of objects when in Britain, the humble umbrella. Plus, we take to the skies and pick apart the new but not necessarily improved print offering available on board one Scandinavian carrier.
A lot of people travel to Scandinavia from all over the world for this incredible design and architectural and interesting experience that we have to offer. That should start from the moment that you start your flight with SAS by offering up some great, interesting publications from the Nordic region.
All that and much more besides coming up today on The Stack, the one-of-its-kind print industry review and analysis programme here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 130 of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. As promised, a bit of a British focus today on the show, and to guide us through a positively kaleidoscopic array of printed titles, I'm lucky to be joined by two magazine industry insiders and aficionados. Anthony Teasdale, formerly of Arena Magazine, Esquire, and most recently, editor-in-chief of the culture and lifestyle title Umbrella. And we also have Rick Moran, creative director at Overture London, an agency focused on brand, PR and design for business. Rick's also a photographer primarily interested in urban environments, from architecture to documenting the disappearing and fleeting. Anthony and Rick, welcome both to The Stack. Great to have you with us on the show. Anthony, perhaps I'll start with you. I've got a nice sort of fresh, you know, copy of Umbrella here in my hands. Just, I guess I'll ask you about that first of all. How's it going? What's the world of Umbrella like? Treating you well, I hope.
Yeah, it's unbelievably exciting. Well, maybe that's overselling it a little bit. We started off as an e-magazine 4 or 5 years ago. There was two of us, me and the art director, Matt Reynolds. And it was a magazine that we felt reflected the interest in publishing of the time, especially online, blogs. And we had this feeling that sort of cool blokes we knew were also interested in quite geeky things. So that was maps, secret tunnels, hidden underground railway stations, all these sort of things. You know, you'd go online, you'd notice fellas arguing about which was the best way, the best bus to get out of Manchester city centre to get somewhere. And it merges those things with style. And that's what we do. And why we're excited at the moment is we seem to have done the complete opposite to everyone else. We've gone from digital to print for the first time. We're going to keep the online presence. You can read the magazine for free on your iPad, but we are now a lovely print magazine which smells delicious.
Smell often underappreciated when it comes to the great print products. Well, we'll talk a bit more maybe about that journey sort of into print and celebration of print, which is very much what we're about, of course, here at Stack. Rick Moran is here. Rick, how's life been treating you? Presumably you're still, you know, reveling in the delightful sights and sounds and smells of print just as ever.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think Anthony and I were talking earlier on about that. It's been a bit of a resurgence in kind of smaller print publishing, something that's quite exciting. I think it's going back to the kind of geeky bloke thing. It's like it's quite a man thing to have something tangible that you can hold. Prior to coming on today, I was raiding boxes in my office and in the loft trying to dig out old copies of various magazines, which, much to my wife's disgust, they're cluttering up the house. And, you know, I think that's something that, you know, the tangible kind of object of a magazine is something that's, you know, still really relevant and really important.
And it's interesting. I mean, Anthony was already talking about this, kind of going from sort of the digital realm back into magazines. And there is this feeling that you've kind of, I don't know, there's a feeling of almost arrival. There's still a feeling that it's almost more special. Is there still a primacy, I don't know, when it comes to the printed page ahead of these other things? There's a lot of great websites doing a lot of great work, but it's still the best, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's an intimacy as well. It's something that you can really enjoy and you know where you are with it. You know, I use digital for a myriad of different things, you know, in terms of organising things day to day, but still I've got a notebook and things like that. You know, so it's nice to have something that's there and you can see and you can touch and feel. And again, going back to the smell as well, it's one of the first things that I do when I pick up a piece of print, quite weirdly, quite perversely to a lot of people, is you smell it and, you know, and you can't get that with digital. You can't get that kind of like extra dimensions, extra sensory dimensions, really.
That's not weird here. You're in like-minded company.
Brilliant.
It's safe. Yeah. It's like kind of like a therapy session here on the stack. Anthony, I wanted to pick up on this idea of the sort of the detail. You talked about that already, and it's really important. I think, you know, leafing through Umbrella, you can see that appreciation of the detail. Is that a sensibility? I don't know. Is it an editorial sensibility, or is it something different? Is it almost part of someone's personality, that appreciation for, you know, the fine point, the fine detail? Where does that really come from?
I think it comes from me and Matt's perspective, is that we're both mods. International listeners may not know that mods were, you know, these great dress guys of the 60s, great Italian suits, working class. And we come from that background. And there is a fascination with detail. You know, I think, was it Mies van der Rohe said that you know, the devil's in the detail? What did you
Absolutely,
know,
yeah.
And that's what we're about. It's an appreciation of things which can be seen as ordinary as well. Yeah. You know, in the new issue of Umbrella, we have a feature on our favourite city crests, you know, the sort of badges you'd see when you drive into a town. Yeah. And it's noticing that and saying, that's actually worth looking at and that's worth investigating. And that is what Umbrella's about. I think it's quite a male thing, but we do have, you know, when I look on our Facebook page, at least a third of them are women. So some women are, you know, as ridiculously geeky as us.
Geeks come in all shapes and sizes and genders, indeed.
Yeah.
Rick, what about for you? I mean, I love this idea of you sort of poring over, you know, these boxes of crusty old magazines in your attic. And so many of our guests have exactly the same experience. And usually another half is saying, isn't it time you threw these out?
Yes, absolutely.
But tell me, so what when you were kind of browsing through, and obviously you've got a whole bunch of these magazines here, which we'll talk about as we go through the program, but what was the thing you were looking for? Is it great cover images? Is it like we talked about the smell, does a smell strike you and you're like, oh, that takes me back to the, you know, early 1980s or whatever it is? What were you sort of looking for as you delved through your own personal archive?
I guess there was a few magazines that I wanted to pull out that were particularly either, you know, they actually meant something to me, or they were particularly kind of groundbreaking in what they did. I think from a smell perspective, which we keep touching on, they probably all smell a little bit musty and dusty now.
Nothing wrong with that at all.
No, absolutely. One of the magazines that I brought in was an early copy of The Face, which was such a formative thing for me. And, you know, Neville Brody was at the helm then. It's a 1986 copy. The content of The Face at that time was so important. It was, you know, it was insight into subcultures that, you know, as a 16-year-old in Rochdale at that point, I had a kind of window onto all these different interesting subcultures. And that's, you know, that was something that was really important and something really formative. Again, I brought in another magazine which was quite important from a kind of design perspective, which was Ray Gun, which had David Carson at the helm. You know, still stands up as very kind of cutting edge. He famously once set an interview with Brian Ferry all in Zap Dingbat, so you couldn't actually read it. So it had that kind of subversive edge to it. So, you know, I guess they were two things that kind of leapt out in particular, because I suppose there's certain things that you kind of assign to a time in your life or that were quite formative.
Why don't we look at that in a bit more detail, particularly that the Face you've got, because I think, Anthony, you've got a copy of The Face from a slightly later era as well, classic edition. But Rick, tell me about this one then, sort of as you leaf through, what is it? You mentioned this sort of, you know, connecting something bigger, you know, this outside world that was very, you know, exciting, different from maybe your immediate surroundings. Is there anything that really speaks to that sense more than anything else, perhaps?
Well, this particular copy I actually picked up a few years ago. I've got quite a lot of 90s issues similar to the one that Anthony's got. This was one from back in 1986, and I picked this up in particular because there was kind of an article about kind of pre-acid house music and the Chicago scene and things like that. So that was very kind of indicative of the sorts of things that they would cover, and the fact that they would cover, you know, emerging subcultures. And they had some, you know, some brilliant writers at the time. And you know, the thing that also attracts me to this particular copy was it was the art direction of Neville Brody, who, again, that was something that was very, very influential on me from a design perspective. And Neville Brody, who's gone on from somebody who was quite kind of rebellious and quite kind of anti-establishment, and has kind of come full circle, and now with like research studios, they were involved in designing the BBC website. So it's interesting how somebody who was quite, you know, anarchic almost in the publishing industry then to come all the way through.
It's always that story. If you have the great ideas, you end up kind of becoming the establishment almost inadvertently.
Yeah, I think Neville Brody said something, you know, in order to break the rules, you first have to learn the rules. Mm. And he studied at the Royal College of Art, and, you know, his thing was, you know, let's learn about it and then let's kind of rip it up. So it's quite ironic that he ends up kind of working for the BBC down the line.
Anthony, what about the copy of the face that you brought along with you? What was it? Is it again? Does it prompt sort of certain memories?
Here is treasure. What I would say about this is that it promised a life that maybe I wasn't leading or wanted to lead.
Yeah, absolutely.
To lead. And I think, you know, say Monocle will do that as well. You know, if I am in a small northern town and I buy a copy of Monocle, it tells me that there is a life that I can improve, that I can base my own life on.
Yeah.
And the face did that. And this issue is, it's chock full here. It's chock full of goodness.
Gold.
It's
And everything from design to content to great writing, it ticks all the boxes.
Yeah, it's got the London v Manchester special. Now, at the time, Manchester was, you know, despite the fact I come from 35 miles to the west, perhaps a far superior city, Manchester was an extreme...
Careful, don't upset people. Our engineer's punching the air behind the glass there, you know, you can tell what side of that fence he's on.
But Manchester was a huge and exciting place at the time. And it was great that the London press, which often ignored the North, wrote about this. It wrote that why Manchester was great, why London was great. And this, there was this absolute vitality. And I think you get this vitality in England, which I love.
Yes.
And this magazine nails that. There's also something really interesting in this, which is a feature about Italia 90, but all the fashion that's going to come for Italia 90. So it's written in about May 90. And you see for the first time Burroughs' classic No a la Valencia T-shirt, worn with white jeans. And that is the start, to me, of when you get this new football culture, post-hooliganism football culture. And it begins, perhaps for me, being documented in this issue. It's a brilliant historical artifact.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about also football and sort of fanzines and that culture as well as we continue to delve through Anthony's stack of magazines. Anthony Teasdale and Rick Moran, both with us here on the stack, and we'll be hearing more from both of them after this. This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, it's time to leave all things British for a moment or two and head for the skies, metaphorically at least. The in-flight magazine is something that we value and treasure on The Stack. Last year, on episode, I think off the top of my head, 111, we devoted a whole show to the topic. Scandinavian flag carrier SAS has just announced that it is to digitise the onboard offering to passengers, much reducing the availability of printed material available at the gate or on board, and making tablet magazine service Readly available to passengers. More choice, maybe, but this change has its limitations and certainly doesn't signal an improvement in editorial content, in our view. Our producer David Pleasant spoke to Wing Creative account managers Emily Argren and Adam Thompson on the skill of catering to the in-flight reader.
As we prepare for takeoff, please make sure that your tray table is stowed and that your seat is in an upright position.
So Adam and Emily from Wing Creative, thank you for joining us for this little discussion on a kind of small issue, but, you know, quite an important issue, especially for us on the stack. News from carrier SAS that their onboard reading will go digital is what they've announced. This comes, there's going to be a plethora of different titles available digitally, including access to a service called Readly, which offers some 12,000 different publications available to passengers. First of all, having a look at this, what's your reaction? What do you think as a potential SAS passenger?
Well, it's a sign of the time, sadly, to a degree. So, you know, this kind of breadth of opportunity when it comes to digital. The thing which really doesn't quite sit with SAS as a brand for me is that they're pushing at the moment a real kind of design story. So you feel that has to have a perspective. And, you know, by going and travelling with them, you want to be kind of welcomed to their world. And so by having this kind of huge wealth of options when it comes to print media, perhaps it dilutes the experience slightly.
And Emily, maybe we should mention that the SAS in-flight magazine will still exist. It is the Scandinavian Traveller. As a Scandinavian person, somebody who knows the brand, you know, what's your reaction to what is currently on offer in the physical edition?
I think currently that's the great pleasure about coming on board SAS Flight is that you have time to read. That's a privilege that a lot of the time you look at a computer screen or a phone for your day-to-day activities. And having that time on board a flight is usually my prime time for picking up an actual physical copy of something to read. And that's when I want to read a lovely in-flight magazine that's going to give me some good new tips on where I should be going in Copenhagen next time I go home, or if I'm going to Stockholm, I want to know what's new and happening there. Also, I think this is a time when, for me, I love picking up a Danish newspaper. I don't have access to it as much here on a day-to-day basis, except for online. So that's my favorite part, is getting on board the flight, picking up my Danish newspaper, and actually sitting down and spending some time with that on my flight to Copenhagen.
And this is something that we've sort of picked up on before on the Stack, is just what a kind of wonderful trapped market or opportunity the in-flight service is. And maybe SAS is missing a trick by sort of flooding passengers with this perceived choice, whereas actually maybe passengers want a little bit less choice and more quality. Would you agree, Adam?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, when you fly with a particular carrier, you kind of subscribe to their worldview in many ways. And so, and that's part of the enjoyment of flying with different carriers, because you get introduced to that country and their culture from the off. So in some ways, offering that huge breadth of choice actually is detrimental, in that you then kind of allow for that slightly globalized view to come into it. Also, I know you mentioned Readly earlier. I think there's how might you use something like that to whittle down and create a more kind of editorially led feel for it? It'd be very interesting to actually see how they use that, and whether they do actually offer up, you know, tens of thousands of titles, or whether they say, here is our selection that, you know, we recommend. Because at the moment on there, you have everything from kind of like muscle fitness magazine to Take a Break or something like that. So it's not in line with their brand values. So how do you actually take that and, you know, edit and select the magazines?
If we kind of go back to the SAS offering, and perhaps that notion of kind of curating a product that is geared towards that market or that kind of country, what would you like to see available on that? Let's look at that particular airline and that particular service. Emily?
I think for me, one of the things that I feel is missing at the moment with SAS is a bit of a curated experience. At the moment, it's very clean, sophisticated, and minimalistic. And a lot of people travel to Scandinavia from all over the world for this incredible design and architectural and interesting experience that we have to offer. And that should start from the moment that you start your flight with SAS. And I think this is a real opportunity for SAS to add a bit of character to their brand by offering up some great, interesting publications from the Nordic region that could really increase and stimulate people's interest in where they're going, and also open up people's mind to some different types of publications. At the moment, one of my favorite is Oak, the Nordic journal, which looks at Scandinavian lifestyle. And that's the sort of thing that I want to be introduced to when I get on board. And that's the sort of thing that gets me excited about going to where I'm going.
Regular travelers are busy people. No one understands that better than Scandinavian Airlines.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Emily Argren and Adam Thompson of Wink Creative about some in-flight offers. More from my guests on the Stack, Anthony and Rick, after this.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me today, editor of Umbrella, Anthony Teasdale, and the media commentator and magazine aficionado.
Yeah.
Rick Moran, happy with that?
Yes.
Rick and Anthony, both with me. Rick, perhaps let's continue through the stack of magazines you've brought today. We were in, was it 1986, a moment or two ago? Yeah. Where did you want to take us now? There's a rich and varied range you've got there.
I think I'm going to bring you right up to date with, ironically, The Modernist, which is a publication out of Manchester. They've been going a few years now. They describe themselves as a quarterly magazine about 20th century design. So it's everything from architecture, furniture, so on and so forth. Something that will appeal to Anthony is they do walking tours around Manchester. And I think this is actually featured in Umbrella, hasn't it?
Yeah, that map.
That's a thing of beauty.
Which is a map of all the kind of modernist buildings around Manchester. They've done really well. They've just gone through a kind of, I think it was Kickstarter. They did some self-funding and now they can. They're going a little bit bigger. They're also expanding into potentially some book publishing as well. But I think largely it's the subject matter with this. I think, you know, I'm quite into kind of modernist architecture. I'm quite into brutalism. And to have this kind of nice publication that kind of touches upon that and goes in quite detail about that is really good.
And it's quite clever, you know, just looking at it. It's a sort of smaller format thing, but there's something about the treatment, the presentation of the images. It does definitely have that kind of like a brutalist era pamphlet quality almost. It's quite cleverly realised, isn't it?
Absolutely. I've always got a big thing whenever I design things as well. I think some really important thing is the size of something. Mm. And it's amazing if you just kind of like book the trend from A sizes that straight away something feels considerably different. I can see, you know, Umbrella's got that. Mm. And just as soon as you pick it up, it feels different. And I think that's what they've done very well. They've now branched out and they've got a kind of false front cover on as well in this kind of shocking magenta pink, which is really nice as well. And the typography is very much of that era. It's very much of the kind of modernist era. But, you know, the design's beautiful. Talking about Mies van der Rohe, there's something on his Barcelona pavilion in there. So, yeah, and I think it appeals very much to that kind of the architect in me. You know, I'm a great wanderer of cities. I like to wander around and discover old estates and things like that. So, yeah, it appeals to me on many levels.
Anthony, it's interesting. We're really getting a sort of bit of a snapshot of British publishing and great British magazines. And there is an appreciation of detail of, you know, British cities and some of these themes. What do you think about I guess it's a bit of a state of the nation question, really, the publishing scene? We talk a lot about great independence, that sort of thing. Obviously, there's pressures and contractions from some of the big publishers. But is it a happy place to be working in at the moment? Is it a good place to be, you know, running a great magazine in, the sort of modern British magazine?
Yes, I think it's more exciting now than it has been in years. I think if you'd asked people, say, about a year and a half ago, there was general gloom and doom. I think what I would say is that what we thought was going to be the great panacea, the tablet, is actually not the solution.
Mm. No.
It's amazing how quickly people have arrived at that, that view, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was working recently over at Esquire Weekly, which was an iPad mag. Brilliant. Really convenient, full of great content. Yeah, and it closed, you know, and I think people do not want to pay for digital content, certainly in this country. But we have a lot of people who read digital content. I think if I'm right, is it half of the advertising spend now is digital? I think that came out this week. So what print becomes, especially in this country, is, without sounding horrendous, a bit boutiquey, and that does sound horrendous, that print is something that's a little bit special, that isn't going to appeal to everyone. Because I think if you see a load of workmen on a lunchtime, they'll be just checking their big iPhones, the Samsungs. So it becomes something a little bit more special, something that, you know, we collect, and you have that personal relationship. And because of that, there's loads of great stuff around at the moment. You know, you go into something like Wardour News in London or Charlotte Street News, and there's just brilliant, brilliant magazines there, Kinfolk or Serial, and, you know, and I think Monocle is part of that as well.
Absolutely.
I think Monocle's quite an influence on that whole scene. So it is exciting. You know, there's some friends of mine did a World Cup magazine over the summer called Mondial, which did really, really well. And that shows that there are people who want to buy this stuff. And they're buying it not just for the content. They're buying it for what it says about them as people, that it goes on their coffee table, that they walk around on the bus with it. And it says, this is a, it's almost like an item or a hat.
Yeah,
obviously you wouldn't wear it as a hat.
You could do.
Well, there's an artifact nature to it, isn't there? Mm. It's, you know, it's having something, and I think, you know, as you touched upon, like some of the great kind of bookstores and magazine stores now in London, you know, people go there and they find things, and they're much more likely to stumble across things than, you know, browsing through the Apple store. I think not people have yet to really kind of grasp publishing on the iPad. I don't think they've, you know, done it properly. And as you say, people are reticent to pay for it. I don't, you know, because you get so much good digital content for free, you know, they don't mind shelling out, you know, 6-7 quid for a magazine that feels like they've got something tangible and it's a nice object that you can take home. But, you know, something that's just stored on the depths of your iPad, I don't think has the same resonance.
Something. Let's continue through stacks. Anthony, I know you just mentioned the idea of, you know, what do your magazines say about you when you've got them tucked under your arm, reading on the tube, or if they're on your coffee table? What's something else? What other have you got there? And what does that say about you, I guess, is the question.
Okay, well, I've got a very interesting magazine here, which is from, I think, about 1986 or 1987. It's the first sort of magazine I ever really liked. I was a 12, 13-year-old lad, called The End. And The End was produced by people who would later go on to form the Farm Pop group. Yeah. And The End did something that had not really been done before. It wrote about ordinary working class life in cities. So I have a copy of The End here, which has a picture of the 80s comedian Alexis Sale on the front in what can only be described as a small pork pie hat.
There's probably some Dr. Martin boots.
And aside from some of the terrible poetry in The End, there is some really great stuff. You know, there's a feature on the stereotypes of urban life of the 80s. So there's a feature called Hot Dog Man, which is, you know, a portrait of blokes who used to sell hot dogs. There are features on Sunday League football and women who go to bingo. And it's finding that humour. And The End wrote about a life that I was familiar with, in the way that The Face, when I was a bit older, wrote about this incredible London life where everyone was very, very beautiful and everyone knew Bruce Weber. The End wrote about places I knew, bus stops I knew, and it did so in a funny way. Yeah. And I think, and James Brown has said that, not James Brown, the godfather of soul, but James, the publisher, he said that, you know, The End was a huge influence, and it was also an influence on Boyzone, and then that influence is in turn loaded. And that is a talking about what we're into. And I think what I would call lads are perhaps the most hated part of society at the moment, the young British male. But that's something I'm very passionate about, you know, the thought of young British men, because I would say they are one of the most creative groups in the whole world, responsible for so many trends that have gone global. Yeah. And they tend to be into interesting stuff. So these magazines from The End onwards write about that, and I'm always amazed at the young British male's talent for doing something new and doing something daft and doing it with humour. And The End did that, and I think that's really important. And I think we should be writing about that, and I think those tales need to be told still. And in Umbrella this month, we have a feature about growing up in Runcorn, which is a new town near Liverpool. You know, and that's a background that a lot of us have got, that we come from places like that, but no one else wants to tell those stories. So I think those sharp young British lads are people who can actually buy our magazines, and I think The End starts it.
Fantastic. Rick, let's carry on. What have you got next? I noticed you'd leafed through a couple of pages. What have you drawn out of your stack next?
Well, quite interesting from The End, I think, you know, and we're talking about The Face as well, there's quite a lineage from, like, the End through to The Face, and as Anthony touched upon, the kind of boy, some of the earlier Junior Boyzone stuff. Mm. And Junior Boyzone then went on to produce a fanzine called Faith, which was very much based around acid house culture, but it was everything from, you know, it's that post-Italian 90 football, house music, clothing culture. And quite ironically, when we were talking earlier, there is actually an article on Ugly Sportswear within here that's scripted by Anthony Shitlock Stock Drape Coat Teasdale, who is sat opposite me, so quite, you know,
without being sort of horrendous and in-jokey here, I would occasionally wear a Crombie at, like, you know, early 2000s nightclubs, you know, and I'd fully hold my hand up there.
Yeah, and you know, Faith fanzine then continued on and as quite a big online presence, but again, it was something that was, you know, it's quite a kind of very very male-led subculture. There was, you know, there was a lots of girls involved as well. But again, it's about that kind of slightly nerdy male attitude to like, right, into buying records. What trainers have you got? You know, where have your jeans come from? And all those things. And I think, you know, as Anthony says, that kind of drives a lot of these things. And it's still something that's really important.
Mm. I'd say Monocle is very much part of that lifestyle.
Yeah,
now.
Absolutely.
I don't know whether that was deliberate from the start, but I do find it has very modish tendencies to it. And I think that appeals to a lot of us. I buy Monocle and I feel like, you know, I'm that sort of fella who buys Monocle.
Yeah.
And I like its detail. I like the fact that it tells me about sort of Italian jackets with unpadded shoulders. I find those things very interesting. That gives me that one-upmanship, that the great mag should, that you are part of a club.
Absolutely. And is that fun seeing something like Faith magazine, an old, you know...
Yeah.
Is it like seeing an old friend?
It just shows that I've been wasting my time doing this nonsense for far too long.
Not at all. We're almost out of time, but Anthony, perhaps what else have you got? Because you had a couple of, I don't know what we'd call them, counterintuitive selections, perhaps.
Again, it's the same thing. I have a copy here of an Australian women's magazine called Frankie. It's brilliant. It's what I would like women's mags in this country to be like. You know, my wife bought it and I ended up reading it more than she did. It's beautifully designed in that nice-smelling, slightly rough paper, designy way that I believe is fashionable at the moment. It is just full of great interviews and really personal stuff. And that's why I like it. There's an ace thing about girl groups in there and it's beautifully illustrated. And there's a girl who talks about growing up as a Greek Australian. And it's really, really personal. And to me, it's absolutely part of the same tradition as The Face and the End. Mm-hmm. It tells stories about people's lives. It makes you feel part of something, but it also makes you want to aspire to that. That's what great mags do.
Rick, maybe just a final thought. I mean, it's interesting that we seem to have almost gone full circle. You come back to this idea of, you know, great stories told with, you know, by great writers. I mean, content is king, we always say. And that's still at the heart of all of these. I think all of the success stories that we've talked about, at the heart of it is great ideas that have real power to connect with the reader in a very immediate way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's a resonance with things that you're into. It's something that kind of reflects your interests. And it's kind of feeling like you're part of a little club as well. I think, you know, going back to things like The Face, you know, you read that and you got involved in subcultures that you weren't really involved in, but by reading about them, you felt part of it. And, you know, there was something there. And I think that's what, you know, that's what great magazines do. They make you feel part of something and they reflect things that you're into.
Well, thank you both very much indeed for being part of the stack this week. I feel we've done an encyclopedic tour through the, I don't know, a couple of generations at least of great British magazines, bringing us bang up to date, of course, with the latest Umbrella. The editor, Anthony Teasdale, thanks for being with us. Rick Moran, thanks for joining us and sharing your expertise as well. And that does indeed bring us to the end of this 130th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Do send us your comments and queries and questions. info@monocle.com is what you need. Don't forget to join us again at the same time next week, Saturday at the very same time. You can always listen again, of course, to this show or any of the others at monocle.com or via iTunes and SoundCloud. But for now, from me and the team, until next time, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.